The Startup to Scale Up Game Plan is brought to you by Alpina Search, Europe's premier talent search firm, dedicated to helping technology startups and scale-ups recruit high-impact executives. Now over to your host, Gary Riemann.
So I'm delighted to welcome Maria Palmer to this week's episode. Maria's a partner at Kindred Capital. They're a London HQ VC. They describe themselves as an equitable venture fund. We'll dig into that a bit later. So Kindred have raised £266 million across three funds. And they've backed startups like Five AI, which was sold to Bosch in 2022. And Atlas ML, which was sold to Meta within a year of raising a seed round from Kindred. So, Maria, a warm and equitable welcome to this week's episode of the Startup to Scale Up Game Plan.
Thank you for having me.
You're most welcome. So just to kick things off, what motivated you to pursue a career in venture capital and what keeps you passionate about the world of VC these days?
I think I sort of navigated there accidentally. I started in corporate America and realized all the jobs I loved were quite ambiguous and kind of building something from nothing, which was not most of my supply chain GE days, even though I really enjoyed my time there because I learned a lot about leadership development and building teams. But I navigated my way actually into startups in a variety of ways before I fell into venture. So I guess I backed my way into venture is probably the best way to describe it, but a friend of mine one day, as I was thinking about what was next after scaling up a company in New York, said to me, "You're always drawn to helping founders. Why don't you go into venture?" And I, at the time, was helping a nonprofit that worked with refugee founders in Africa. I was also working with some tech founders in New York. And I said, "You're right. Maybe I should go into venture." And after meeting and getting rejected by half of the New York venture ecosystem, I decided to go into venture. But to answer your second question, I guess that is what keeps me excited there is really founders. So I think I was drawn to founders and that's what still keeps me very excited every day is in many ways, this job, so long as your track record is good enough that people let you keep doing it, is really a privilege to work with some of the best and brightest founders and people out there trying to shift, use technology to shift the world in a slightly better place most of the time.
Are you still involved with voluntary work and nonprofits even these days?
Not at the moment. I have two kids, 3 and 1. And so as I had my second, I kind of rolled off of everything and stopped my podcast as well. So I'm just trying to some days thrive, but mostly just survive a pretty busy work schedule and parent life and the rest of things. But no, I'm not.
It's amazing you've managed to squeeze in some time to record this podcast with me today. So thanks, Vera. Thanks for finding that time. Now, I'm curious to understand more about the ideas behind Kindred's concept of equitable venture. So could you walk me through the principles behind this and how does it work in practice?
When Kindred got set up in 2016, there was not a lot of venture funds in Europe that had ex-operators. So everyone at Kindred has been a founder or scaled a startup. Now, when we say that doesn't mean that we think we're good operators. It actually just means we know what it's like to be in those shoes and we have a lot of empathy for the journey. It is very, very hard to be a founder. And I think what's funny is it's one of those things where the more you know, the more you realize you don't know. So actually being ex-operators, it doesn't make us show up to a board meeting saying, "Here's how to do an enterprise sale." It actually makes us say, "You know what? You are building and we're not. So the best thing for you to do is learn from other people building right now." If you're, let's say, hiring a product manager, it was different 3 weeks ago, 3 months ago, 3 years ago. And so what we wanted to do is set up the venture fund that we wish we had all had when we were on the operating side. And one of those things is actually diversification. So if we back a founder, as any venture capitalist would do, we believe that they can build a massive billion-dollar, multi-billion-dollar company. And they're usually building with a pretty important mission in mind. At the same time, the power law returns is what drives venture. And we didn't like the idea that you might spend 10 years building a company and just because of market timing, you get zero and we walk away beautifully diversified as a VC. So we thought we should share upside with founders. So we are an equal partnership, but we give a sizable chunk of the carry back to founders. So if we invest in their company, they get upside of the other companies in the fund with them. And what we find is that it actually just builds this community where founders really are incentivized and want to help the other founders in the fund as they're continuing to build. So we hosted our founder retreat last week and we had everybody in the room and we put up the number. It said, this is what the number that would be our carry that we've given to you, and said, you guys should all share each other's upside without giving any equity. And we said, if you want that number to go up, talk to each other over drinks, talk to each other tonight, and find ways to help each other succeed.
Great motivator to encourage networking and learning. So you mentioned diversity. What have you done, either personally or as a fund, to proactively encourage or improve diversity across the portfolio?
So it's something we're constantly thinking about. Thought about it both in my last fund in New York and here. I'd say there's a few things you can do. So one is that we track the funnel. We have to be careful to track it a specific way from a GDPR compliance perspective, but we like to track the funnel and see what our natural deal flow is. And then if our natural deal flow is not diverse enough, then we can go out and find other places to look for deals. We also try to create a diverse partnership. So I think from a gender perspective of our GPs, we're sort of 2 out of 5, but can also be better on other dimensions, other types of backgrounds that we've thought about. And then as we add people to the network, I think it's something that's a kind of a constant top of mind for us. It's a very tricky challenge in venture. And I saw the same thing in the US, though the US has, they're very different flavors of challenges in both. Like, for example, in Europe, you get also an element of class that isn't as strong in the US, but the US has other issues. One thing I did in the US was help to build a nonprofit called NYC Blend, which helped underrepresented founders get access to venture. And there's a few learnings across all of these things. One is just the importance of social relationships. So I think there's a lot of like office hours where VCs and founders can book in time with VCs. I tend to not be a fan of that model. Nothing against it. I think you can do that as well, but we haven't seen it translate to actual investment. And then the second thing that's really important is the importance of having founders have ways to reach you, even if they don't have a network. So we are one of the only venture funds I think I know of that responds to every single cold email to like our hello@kindredcapital.vc. And in my last fund also, we had a way to basically respond to a leadership question if you didn't have a way to get to us through a network, because a lot of the network warm referrals aspect of venture is what makes diversity and inclusion a continued issue around access to VCs.
And within the portfolio companies, do you encourage them or go even beyond encouragement in terms of their approach to hiring at senior level from a diversity perspective?
Yeah, we actually think about it as diversity, but also as broader ESG. So we have an ESG toolkit for really early stage companies. So we help companies at the various earliest stages think about things like diversity in hiring, things like some of the decisions they're making that then have knock-on effects for sustainability and climate. So there's a number of things that we've translated back to the earliest stages where you can actually really affect it right from the onset.
Now, you mentioned your own podcast earlier in this conversation, Founders Uncut, to give it a quick bit of publicity there. So you interviewed founders and uncovered the moments of fear and doubt that even the most successful founders face. So what were some of the most surprising or shocking revelations that you unearthed during those interviews?
I think, well, tying these things together, I think it's also just putting diversity in whatever you do. So I wanted to also have a diverse set of voices when I did that podcast. But the interesting thing is, I find that in Europe, there's more imposter syndrome around being a founder. The reason I have a thesis or hypothesis for why that is, it might not be accurate, but in the US, you have these extreme density centers, right? In New York and SF, and you do have other ecosystems, but everyone kind of knows everyone. And so when you get that TechCrunch article that's like, oh, this company just raised a lot, they're doing well, half the people are like, oh, I know that company, they're not really doing that well, or it's not been easy. And in Europe, because there's less press, like you do have Sifted and stuff, most of the founders I know in Europe do read a lot of articles from the US, but they don't know all the companies. And so there's this feeling that everyone is like doing better than you and it's easier for them. And it's just not true. It just feels like that. And so I think it's just important to socialize and normalize the fact that like, if it feels hard, it's not you. That is just running a company. It is very, very difficult to be a founder. And I think that there's almost this sense, especially when I meet early stage founders, it's like, oh, it's going to be easy someday. Like, oh my God, imagine those people at Series B and C that have raised so much money. Like they must just have it so much easier. Then you talk to those founders and it's just a new set of problems, sometimes much bigger problems than they ever thought they would have. And I think the theme across it is, you know, whether you're talking to, just talking to Tom from Monzo, who obviously scaled very quickly, or Flory from BlockFi, whose company went from a little bit to $3 billion to back to a small amount. And these journeys have a lot of different twists and turns. And I think it's never straightforward. And so there's a few specific examples throughout the podcast that I spoke to the founders about, but I would just say it's never easy. So whatever the problem is, it's not you. It's just how it feels to run a company. And if it took you 100 people to get to a yes on your fundraise, that's actually not that uncommon. So part of it is just socializing it. But I think if I go to your question about surprise, one of the things that sticks with me is I had George Bevis on who built Tide. And I remember him talking about some startups that he failed at before or failed to achieve what he wanted to. And he just talked about this feeling of relief when he finally decided to let it go. It's a bit counterintuitive because he was like, you'd think it'd be harder when I decided to fail, but actually when it was the right decision to quit the company, there was actually just a feeling of relief as soon as I made that decision. And I've actually seen that since he was on my podcast talking about it two or three times with founders.
So who is venture capital really for, or rather, who is it not for?
The best analogy is probably that I can come up with is probably something that Mark Suster at Upfront Ventures said once, which was VC is like rocket fuel. If you're building a rocket, you need it. But if you're not building a rocket, it's probably not going to help you and it might just kill you or not allow you to drive further. So I would say, let's just back up and go back to what venture is for a second, because I think sometimes a lot of founders don't spend a lot of time thinking about where VC money comes from and what is the full holistic chain here. There's no VC money that grows on trees, as far as I know, or if you find those trees, take me with you. I'm happy to go to that orchard. Truthfully, we raise from institutions, university endowments, high net worth individuals, family offices. There's a lot of places VCs raise from, but pretty institutional money. So let's take the example of a pension fund. If we raise money from a pension fund and we don't deliver a return, then that fund cannot deliver the retirement they're planning to the people that they are the custodians of that money for. And so there is like a knock-on effect if you look at where the money comes from and how the industry has played out, which we can talk about in a second. But from that perspective, who's the money for? Like, our job is to deliver returns. We're just lucky that we get to do it through founders that are really building interesting companies. But because of the dynamics of many companies going under, you have to have the power law and you have to have some of the companies that become absolutely massive. But I think people forget that if I was a founder today, depending on what the business was, I wouldn't necessarily take venture capital. So if you think that you can exit a company for, like, you can get to revenues of 50 to 200 million or 50 to 100 million, but you really can't get beyond that, I don't know if I would take venture capital, especially if I could grow to like 20 or 30 million, not take equity and, you know, have 20 million in my bank and also build the business I want to build the way I want to build it. That's very attractive. But if you're going to build a pretty generational platform changing company that has to take a lot of money to get there, you sort of have to take venture. So it really depends on what scale you're trying to build to be honest.
What about the mindset of the type of entrepreneur that suits the world of VC? Do you look carefully at that when you're considering investments? And have you got any advice in terms of what you think is the right mindset or the wrong mindset for someone to take on VC funding?
I think we think about mindset a lot. There's no recipe for what a founder should be. And if there was, my job would have been automated away a long time ago. We think a lot about founder traits. I think I will give you a couple that I think about, but there isn't an answer is the answer, honestly. So there's a few things that I think good founders have, but I think back to the diversity and inclusion conversation, you have to not expect them to show up the same way in each person. So let me give you an example. There's something that I stole from the nonprofit world actually called resource magnetism. And it's this concept that basically things and people are to you. And I think great founders have really good resource magnetism. They are able to attract resources. Now, sometimes that might be because they are the charismatic visionary founder you can imagine, right? And sometimes it's not. I backed a founder at my last fund and this person was very soft-spoken, not very tall, wouldn't have walked into a room and like commanded the room. And yet everything just gravitated towards her, right? People wanted to take a chance on her. People wanted to work with her. And I think that this resource magnetism concept does resonate with me because you have to attract really good talent as a founder. That's one of the most important skills you can possibly have. And I think another two or three things that I see in really good founders, one is that they are able to make tough decisions quickly. So I look if they've done that somewhere else in another setting, and they're able to listen to their gut. I think one of the hardest things founders have to get right is you do need to take on advice sometimes, right? Be it from your investors, other founders, your customers. So you do have to be able to listen and change what you're doing. But also sometimes you actually don't need to listen and you need to say, you know what? I'm trusting my gut here and I know that this is the right decision. And this is not something that I need to listen to people's advice for. And the distinction between the two, very hard to get right.
So this lady you just mentioned that you backed in your last fund, I think it was your last fund. What did she have or project or convey that made people gravitate towards her?
I think it's different in every person. In this specific case, she was so good at what she was doing. I think that her domain expertise in what she was doing and ability to show, like, she was also very scrappy. So like what she had been able to build with very little was just impressive. And I think within a very short amount of time, she just got you excited about what she was building. And at the end of the day, there was a good podcast the other week with the CEO of Cloudflare on 20VC. And he was debating that everyone gives advice these days to go to a smaller and smaller niche, or that's what Harry was saying. And he was like, no, you need a big vision. And there was a founder I was speaking to last night that we are very sadly not investing in, but we got very close. And he was right. He was like, if I don't have a wide enough vision, I will not get the best talent. The best talent wants to work on really big game-changing visions. And I think that generally is true. So you either have to have something where it's a mission that excites people or the vision is big enough, depending on which type of talent you are trying to attract. But going back to your mindset, you have to have a mindset of scale, like that is required for venture. That doesn't necessarily have to mean scale of people, by the way, especially in the new world of AI. I think that companies are being built differently and they may not have armies of people the way that they used to. And so the type of leadership that you need, that's actually something I've been thinking a lot about recently, is we look into types of leadership and can people build good cultures, good teams. And if you're going to have thousands of people, you need that. If you're going to build a huge company with 20, 30 people, you might not need that as much. And so this is something we're thinking through now, but you need a mindset of scale and a mindset of resilience where you're just constantly busting through really tough challenges. Because at the end of the day, these are very audacious visions to bring to reality, and they're never straightforward.
You talked about your job being automated away a few moments ago, a very different context to where I'm coming from now, but that got me thinking, with AI making inroads into so many sectors, do you think 5 years' time, 10 years' time, do you think VC, as we currently know it, is going to be around, or do you think AI will take over a lot of the work that someone like you does?
First of all, I definitely don't have a crystal ball. So, I mean, 5 to 10 years actually feels like a long time, given what the types of changes we're seeing now. But things also, change also has to happen at a digestible pace to some extent. Humanity will require it in a way. But I think I'm not so worried about early stage venture being automated away in the 5-year version. And maybe even in the 10-year, I think where there's a lot of automation around numbers and seeing the growth of companies, that there, I think there's more automation. I'm less worried about it. And I actually think there's probably, it's kind of like when crypto, when ICOs happened and people said, do you need venture? Well, it depends on how many rounds you're raising and if you're going to have an up or a down round. And so I think I worry less about my job being automated away today. I actually think if we're going to see VC around as an asset class the same way it is today, it's probably way more a question of liquidity and returns that we're going to see in the next 3 to 5 years will drive that more than AI in the short term, I think. Meaning there's a huge liquidity crisis and we haven't seen the returns that we needed to as an industry, both at the VC and the LP level. And if that isn't rectified by some of the next years of exits and what AI might enable, I think there will be a number of changes in VC.
I'm sure you're right. And just expanding on the market for VC, you mentioned when we last spoke that you're long on Europe and pretty enthusiastic about the prospects for AI in Europe as a sector to invest in. So what's the European VC bull case?
I mean, everyone has a view on European VC. I think there's a lot of reasons to be long European VC, but I think some of them are quite obvious. But I'm going to go with two that I think about a lot. One is that compared to like the US, where I think there's a lot of reason why tech has done well and will continue to do well in the US, there are the other job, BATNA, as you will, or like the alternative is what they call. And if you're talking about negotiation, there's this concept of BATNA, which is like, what is your walkaway? What is your other alternative? And in the US, your alternative job market is much stronger than it is in Europe. So if you're a young person in Europe, a lot of markets, like specifically France and Germany, let's take, they have very linear career progression. So you study something, you better do that thing, and you better keep doing that thing. And the truth is, young, smart people don't want that anymore, right? They want to be able to learn something, do really well at it, and then try something new. So I was talking to a really impressive founder the other day who's now since gone to Mistral, speaking of AI, but she at her prior startup was running three different divisions, right? You know, she was doing product and then she got put into sales because they need help in sales. And then she got put into something else. And that would never have happened in a career outside of tech and startups. But that is what young people want. And so I think you're going to see more and more of the great talent go into tech in Europe than you have in the past, because it's just a better career option for them for the short and the long term. And then hopefully we see some exits that also keep people staying in tech. But then the second thing is actually a deep science background. So I think one of the advantages Europe has over the US in this AI explosion, and the US has some clear advantages too, to be honest, but is that one of the things that we think is most interesting. Well, let's back up. You kind of have three specific VC reactions to AI the way I see it. You have VCs who are kind of all in AI. So if you're a credible founder, you've come from DeepMind, or you have anything to do with AI, you'll get a term sheet. Maybe defensible, maybe not, but you'll get a term sheet. Then you have the other extreme, which is like the wait and see VCs. So you have people who are worried that nothing is defensible because every 2 weeks ChatGPT releases a new feature, or Facebook just released their automatic code software this morning. And then like 25 startups or 100 startups go under based on one announcement realistically. So they're just not playing in it right now. We're in the middle in what I'll call thematic conviction, which means that we have areas that we think are defensible, but a lot of the areas that we've invested in to date in AI are actually outside of language models. So things like biology and chemistry. So companies looking at new medicines and new protein models where you have to build the models from scratch because that data just doesn't exist. And I backed a company in Berlin that's a climate change company realistically, but they're looking for new catalysts. And so they're using AI and robotics in a lab to find new catalysts. So hopefully finding eventually green fuel. And what's interesting is if you look at the marrying AI and science together, a lot of that deep domain expertise is in Europe. So you have people who have been doing their PhDs in biology and chemistry for many, many years at a scale that I think is more interesting in a way than the US. And so I think that combination will be very interesting for us to watch in the coming years.
So Europe sounds like it's quite strongly positioned in terms of vertical markets, vertical applications of AI rather than some of the more generic LLM type approaches.
Yeah, I don't think Europe is going to win at a foundational model level for sure. I think it's more some of the specific applied sciences versions today. And then also some of the language stuff might happen, but it'll be in very specific defensible ways.
And I know, again, from a previous conversation we had, that you've got a really strong thesis about the Gartner hype curve. Your view is that technologies don't naturally follow the curve, rather it's the VC mechanism, overfunding and hype that puts technologies into these different stages. So could you elaborate on that a little and maybe suggest some areas that the world of VC needs to improve upon?
Yeah, it's interesting. Well, I mean, as an asset class, we ironically back the most innovative stuff in the world, and yet we rarely innovate on ourselves. And I think this is an area to hold up the mirror a little more strongly, because I don't really believe in the Gartner hype cycle. I mean, I think it happens that way, but I don't think it was meant to. I think that probably if you think about the natural adoption of technology, it would go a little something more like Ernest Hemingway. When asked how he went bankrupt, he said, gradually and then suddenly. And I think that's probably how most technologies would be adopted, is they would come into being and they'd be tested and then they would suddenly take off. But I think because of the VC hype cycle, we create this, right? Like right now, the delta in valuation you're getting, if you're building an AI versus not building an AI right now, is just crazy. It's like 2021 again. And you'd think there would be learnings from like the overzealousness of 2021, but then you get the SVB crash and then you get this. And I think you put all of this money into the same space and you create this bubble. I mean, you know, actually, even stuff that we've been looking at very recently is you just get these valuations where if the hype cycle continues and they can get momentum and keep raising at high valuations, then in theory, it could work. But at the end of the day, the music stops somewhere and you have to build real value at a real valuation that the public markets will agree with. And so you're setting up these companies in many cases for failure. And if you had just kept them at a reasonable valuation until they've built a product and a company, but it's almost like an arms race, right? If there's a really good founder, people are like, oh my God, we have to be in. And the supply and demand just creates these astronomical valuations. But then it gets so overfunded that then when it doesn't work as immediately as we want it to next year, there's a huge bubble. Something will happen. AI will do something that really harms a certain subset of users or something that is a PR scandal and everyone will freak out and there will be a burst and then it will be hard for the founders to raise. Like, we will go through these cycles, but because we keep putting them on this curve, not because they should be that way. But I guess if I was to defend the curve a little bit, I would say because of the liquidity challenges we said before, venture kind of needs a lifeline right now. And so that lifeline starts to look a lot like AI. And what I will say is AI is horizontal, so it's in everything. But if you just want to invest in AI as an LP right now, like if you were in the crypto world, there was lots of ways to invest. And, you know, we were talking about that before, but you can invest directly in Solana, directly in Bitcoin, if you believed in that. But here, if you believe in AI, unless you want to just hold the big public stocks, in which case, arguably, it's already priced in, you can't really get access to it in many other ways besides venture. So I think in some ways, it's a bit of a chicken and an egg, but let's back up to why big valuations are not good. So the way VCs are measured is eventually something called DPI, which is distribution paid in, but basically cash on cash returns. But before that, it's something called TVPI, which is total value to paid in. But this is your paper gains, right? This is like where you hold a position at. So if we take a recent example of an exit, one of the few exits that happened this year, Instacart. Instacart was at one point valued at $39 billion. And it went public for 9.9. And it currently, like last week, sat at 6.8 or something. And so anybody after the Series C didn't make money. And arguably there was a liquidity event. And so it should have made money. But if people priced in and they were going for 39, like as a venture return, is it a success? Probably not for most people or for most people who weren't in the first few rounds, because if you held it at 39 and had to mark it all the way down and you're probably still sitting at 6 billion, you probably didn't make the returns you were expecting to. And everyone past the Series C was better off putting that same money in the S&P 500. So that's not a good case for venture. But the flip side is that Instacart had 13.7 million daily active users last year and exited a company for almost $10 billion. So like, hard to argue that that's not a success. And so to me, it's actually overfunding these things creates unrealistic expectations and creates negative value for everyone. If you're an employee of Instacart and you think your options are worth something tied to a $39 billion valuation, and in the end, they're not, and you're underwater, that doesn't feel good. I think that we need to learn from these things and be realistic about where we're setting expectations. But if you have a few good founders and lots of people chasing after them, people don't want to hear about realistic expectations.
Exactly. Tell me about the funniest or craziest startup pitch you've ever seen. And here, I mean, live at a pitch event, something that left you in hysterics or close to.
Good question. I don't know that I've ever actually had anything that left me in hysterics per se. I think that it's just some interesting ideas that really like take you a totally different direction. Like, for example, there was recently a founder who pitched me on getting rid of SIMs as we know it and basically having a SIM so that you have one thing in your phone that actually works in every single country as if it's a local SIM. And taking on the airline industry is very challenging, but in some ways, like I really believe that this founder could do it. And there's another company, everyone's been thinking about AI and models, and he actually is building a whole model in scent, in the molecules of scent. And he's starting with fragrances, but actually, if you think about it, there's a lot of ways in which the science of scent has not really been explored and doesn't really have a lot of AI models around it. I think if you...
They both sound intriguing rather than funny, actually, but carry on.
Well, I guess funny, people don't have a lot of funny ideas, as it turns out. I guess if you want to talk about funny or blushing, I am invested in a men's sexual health company and the first slide of their deck said 1 billion penises. So that did make me smile. The first time I saw that, I was like, okay, what's this? But then they went on to explain erectile dysfunction and how it's different in young adults versus old adults. And so I guess that one did make me smile or make me laugh and make me curious about what the next page was going to be.
Yeah, that's a good attention grabber on page one. What about the one that got away? The one company you had the chance to invest in, it never came to fruition, and you've regretted it ever since.
Yeah, everyone has some of those. The one that comes top of mind, and you'll know who he is a founder named Yuri, who built a company called Elemi in the US. And it's actually built a company in autism care. And it's a company that we were very, very close to doing. So I had a term sheet out and he was going to sign it. And then it was a very competitive round. And it was very, very, very close. But it's a company that went on to grow really rapidly in the US and also has a lot of positive externalities in what they're doing. And I just think he's a really interesting, incredible founder who scales things very quickly. And I've kept in touch with him since, and he does angel investments and things like that. So have kept in touch, but that one hurt. Yes, definitely.
Have you been?
It was the only time I had a shot of whiskey celebration before it was actually physically signed. Never again.
Oh yeah. That's painful when you celebrate a deal too soon. Had that experience a couple of times myself. Cool. And we're filming this, recording this on Halloween. So I know, well, you mentioned it earlier on, you're a mum to two young kids. So tell me about your plans for this evening.
Well, we are definitely going to do trick-or-treating. I've found where in London we can make that happen. And I'm usually someone who makes costumes from scratch, and I would have spent a lot of time over the last few weeks making a costume. But this year I have given full control to my three-year-old son, and he has picked everyone's costume in the family. So we will be parading around as a family of cars. He's a police car. I've been allocated the blue car in the racetrack. My husband's a Ghostbusters car, and my daughter's a fire truck. So we will be hitting the streets of London as a family of cars later today.
We're all going to look out for a family of high-performance cars wandering around London. Whereabouts in London is this?
Well, actually, it's up for debate. I'm on a mom chat, and there's several debates about where the trick-or-treating is going to happen. So not sure exactly yet, but it will be sorted out by then.
Well, hope you have fun, you and the family. Hope you don't pick up any speeding fines this evening. And thank you so much for joining me on today's podcast.
No problem. Thanks for having me.
This episode of the Startup to Scale Up Game Plan was brought to you by Alpina Search. Head over to www.alpinasearch.com for advice on scaling your technology startup and recruiting high-impact senior talent.